This is episode 413, dated Friday, May 23rd, 2025.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to In Perspective. I am Bob Branco. Great to be here today. This is episode 413, dated Friday, May 23rd, 2025. Before we continue, allow me to introduce our good friend, colleague, and co-host for today's program, Peter O'Toole. Peter, how you doing?
Doing great. Weather here has finally gotten to be late spring, early summer. And for us, that means 65 degrees and sunny and windy. That's usually the way it goes during much of the summer here.
We are on the heels of a nor'easter. We had a nor'easter here in Massachusetts yesterday, very rare for late May. Temperatures only climbed to the high 40s. In fact, I understand there may have been snow in the mountains of northern New England yesterday, believe it or not. But we're warming up gradually, so we're out of the woods, hopefully. Before we continue, let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer. An editor, thank you. Also, our media sources, thank you for airing us when you do. And also, Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions, thank you very much for archiving our programs on my website. All you have to do to find them is go to www.brancoevents.com, arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts, click on them, and you will see most of our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I'd like to say hi to Cindy, our facilitator, and Brad, our streamer for today's program. And because we are being streamed live, let me give out my email address for those people who I encourage to send questions or comments about our show. It is bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. We have back with us former New York Congressman John LeBoutillier, a regular to our program. We are also scheduled to have John Jizzy, political columnist with Newsmax, joining us. He's not here as of yet, but I'm sure that when he arrives, he will let us know. In the meantime, let me just welcome back Congressman LeBoutillier. Congressman, thanks for returning to us. We appreciate it.
Bob, it's my pleasure, and it's a hard G on Gizzy. And,
Gizzy, okay.
Yeah, and I introduced him to this show, and you've had him on. He's a wonderful guest. There is nobody that knows more about every congressional district politically in this country than Gizzy does. He knows the history, what races were tough, primaries, redistricting. It's an uncanny knowledge in his head about this stuff. And he's fascinating to talk to and a great friend of mine for 45 years, I think.
Well, we've had the pleasure of getting to know Mr. Gizzy here, and we concur with what you said.
Yeah. So if he gets on here, it'll be great. But we'll begin while we wait.
We will indeed. And why don't we start with how did you meet Mr. Gizzy? How did you know him 45 years ago?
When I got elected to Congress, when I was running and when I got elected, he was covering all these congressional races. Was it for Roll Call or it was one of those Capitol Hill newspapers, whatever one he originally worked for has gone out of business many years ago. And he ended up at Newsmax where he is now. And his boss who used to work for me, Chris Ruddy, who owns and runs Newsmax, was a 16-year-old intern in my 1980 campaign. And over the years, Chris grew up, obviously, and did very well. And Gizzy was a well-known reporter. I'm really fogging out on the name. It's a famous conservative paper that he worked for.
And I think it was Human Events, perhaps.
Yeah, Human Events. That's it. Human Events.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah. A lot of us in the House became friends with Gizzy. You can't help but like him. And we stayed friends all these years, even though I wasn't in Washington anymore. We stay in touch, talk, you know, a few times every year and sometimes more. And he's fantastic.
So I wanted to talk about other things with you. I was going to talk to you with both of you, but I'm going to talk about with you. And that has to do with this whole Biden cover up, as it will, of Biden's illnesses of maybe dementia and definitely cancer. And it reminded me, and maybe this is an unfair comparison, it reminded me of President Reagan back in his last 2 years of his term, when there's a lot of talk about his mental decline sort of in the media, sort of behind the scenes. And we learned shortly afterwards, he told us that, you know, that he had, I can't remember what he had, or Parkinson's, what's it?
Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's. Thank you. Yeah. And I'm wondering how, in your mind, Congressman, how the two compare.
Well, I think they're very similar in many ways. Number one, when we've all been around elderly people who are deteriorating, and it's not like one day they have a terminal disease and they can't function. It's gradual. So often with older people, they're good in the morning. They fade as they get tired in the afternoon and the evening, stumble for words, search for words, but they're still making sense when they talk. And that
good
was going on.
Bad.
Yeah, there's John Kizzy right now.
Yes. Hello, sir. I just connected with you. I was having a little trouble. Hello, Congressman, and hello everybody.
Giz. Hi, John.
Well, we've introduced you with glowing terms, Giz.
All right. I'll take your word for it. And I don't mean to interrupt, John, but I would add that good days and bad days is the term I've heard applied to members of my family when they got older, to my late wife when she battled dementia for 4 years, and it comes along. I would have to say that in terms of keeping it secret and trying to work around the president who might be incapacitated, I would recommend a novel from 1966, Night of Camp David, by Charles W. Bailey and Fletcher Knebel, the authors of 7 Days in May, and it's about what if a president becomes mentally incapacitated, what one does. And it's fascinating in the sense that so much that was discussed in enacting the 25th Amendment, and later in the cases of President Biden, are mentioned in this novel that was written more than half a century ago. But again,
yeah, and right around the time the 25th Amendment was created, I think. Wasn't that late 60s? Wasn't it?
Just on the eve of it. The 25th Amendment came in 1967. Night of Camp David was 1966.
There you go.
They have it that way. I might add just one more thing. Ronald Reagan had press conferences and interviews, made a national address about Iran-Contra amid what John talks about, the questions about his mental capacity. And it was clear he was in command of things. The only thing that could be said was he did not remember names that well. And that was something he was notorious for. You, John, when you served in Congress, you would probably walk up to him and he knew some members, but others he was clueless as to who they were. And that's just, there's so many jokes about that were made. And I know that it was in 1994, I saw him do a taped interview celebrating the 50th anniversary of the publication I worked for, Human Events, and he clearly had aged and his cadence was much slower. And within weeks after that, he wrote his famous letter saying he had Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, but which was the Saturday afternoon before the November election that catapulted Newt Gingrich to the speakership and the Republicans won the House. That would be right. November something, 1994. So that's 5.5 years after he left the White House. He releases that handwritten letter saying, I've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's and I'm entering the twilight of my life. But he was president 5 years earlier and no one diagnosed anything. He was functioning. Biden was functioning. It's not like someone can walk in and look at the guy and say, oh, he's incapacitated. That's how these diseases are ambiguous. They, you know, there's a, like I said, there's a good morning and a bad afternoon, and you wonder what's going on. Is the guy tired? And by the way, with Reagan, there was an added thing, which was hearing loss. And hearing loss can often cause the guy to go, what? Excuse me? Because he can't really hear, and he looks baffled, and you think he's baffled.
Speak up, son.
Yeah, and you remember the famous time at the ranch when he's president. The press is asking President Reagan a question. She, Nancy's standing next to him, and she prompts him under her breath. She sort of, and the microphone picked it up, doing everything we can. And he then echoes it. We're doing everything we can. It's almost like she was Cyrano de Bergerac. She was scripting him. But was it because of dementia, or was it because of hearing loss? You know, we don't know. We don't know.
And I would also add that President Biden has always had a stuttering problem, right? I mean, he's known for it. And I, whenever I had these, whenever I heard about this, I would think, okay, how much of this to do is he's losing his mental acuity, and how much is because of his stuttering? You know, he always had a stuttering problem, which may have gotten worse as he got older, but he always had that problem.
I'll give you one, Peter, that's in this book that just came out by Jake Tapper. And this is going to show this isn't just the stuttering thing. This is something else where Biden was at the D-Day memorial thing in France and flew all the way, or maybe he was at a NATO conference in somewhere in Italy, I think, flew all the way to L.A. for this big fundraiser hosted by George Clooney. And during all this back and forth to D-Day and NATO, Hunter Biden had been convicted. And Biden then flies all the way from Europe, all the way to L.A., arrives early in the morning, exhausted, and goes to rest somewhere, and then goes to his big fundraiser. And when he's walked up to George Clooney, who's hosting this thing, he doesn't recognize him. And the staffer has to say, that's George Clooney. And then Biden says, oh, yeah, George, great to see you. Now, that's a serious problem. Who on this planet cannot recognize George Clooney, especially when he's the chairman of the evening with Obama there and all, which is raising you a pot load of dough for your campaign? If you're with it, you're going to know who George Clooney is.
On the cancer, though, I have an interesting. Okay, so I think most of us know that in most cases, prostate cancer is a slow grower.
Right.
I find it hard to believe that all of a sudden he has stage 4 prostate cancer after not knowing about it prior. And there was an incident back in 2022 when President Biden came here to Massachusetts for an appearance because of some demolition of some famous building in Somerset, where he said something to the effect that he and other people that he knew had cancer. This was in 2022.
Huh.
So how?
Well, it never got reported. I mean, that may have happened, but. You know, there's no reason. To me, it's beyond belief. Now, I know that the American Medical Association recommends that after you're 70, you don't get the PSA blood test.
I wonder why.
I don't know. Because it won't make any difference at that point. If you get prostate cancer, as you said, it's very slow growing and can be treated, if not cured. That's the story. I don't buy it. I get the PSA. I just had it a year ago at 71. And it's just a test when you're getting your blood tested for cholesterol and everything else. You just check off the box or have the doctor do it and they run the PSA. I mean, you don't have to have anybody sticking their finger up your rear end or any of that stuff. This is strictly the blood test. And he had not had one, supposedly, since 2014.
Only negligent, but dumb.
Well, it is dumb, but I don't know why they allegedly, that's what the doctor recommended. That's 11 years ago. He would have been 71 years old and they elected, he was vice president. They elected not to do the blood test, supposedly.
What I've also heard is that it's not, Biden's not in great shape. Everybody understands that. but it's even though it's stage four, they still think it's treatable. I mean, he's going to die at some point, but it's not as if he's going to die in the next 2 days. He might die, you know, a year from now or 10 years from now is what I read.
Right. Well, it's spread to the bone, which means it's incurable, but apparently the type he has, there are hormone treatments that keep it at bay. And it doesn't mean he will die from that, Peter. He's going to die from something, but not necessarily the prostate cancer.
I've heard that that was the most likely cause of
death. Yeah, could be. But
you're right.
Could be.
Yeah.
I don't understand in any this event, thing. Yeah, get the test. God.
Yeah. And of course, we know that John, as thoughtful and careful as he is about his health, will get it when he turns 72 in a couple of days. So
that is correct. That is correct. Next blood test I'm getting will be in July, I think. And I asked the doctor, just check that thing, you know.
Right. Early happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you, John. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Bob.
Yep.
Yeah, it's on Monday. We celebrate my birthday on Memorial Day this year. And I'm much more interested in celebrating Memorial Day and all the great guys that served our country.
And I'll be broadcasting from Arlington Cemetery that day.
You share a birthday with my late mother.
Oh, well, it's a great day then, Bob.
So, John Gizzi, the last time we spoke, you were headed to Rome to cover the election of a pope. Talk about that experience and what you think might come as a result of the new pope.
Well, I saw conclave not long before I headed to Rome, and I never believed it would be a reality show, but it certainly was. The intrigue, the maneuvering, and the surprise ending all took place at the Vatican outside the Sistine Chapel. Our camera crew was on a rooftop, and I was there when the white smoke came up. The crowd cheered, and the announcement came, "Habemus Papam," we have a pope. The 267th successor in the throne of St. Peter. And what a surprise it was. Robert Prevost, former bishop in Peru, born in Chicago, master of five languages, and someone that nobody was mad at, was elected pope on the fourth ballot. Now, I can say this, that as we watch the new pope and see him in action, good old insider politics, something John Leboutelier learned in Nassau County quite well with the Margiotta machine. It doesn't differ that much in the Vatican. It should be pointed out, Cardinal Parolini, they called him Francis II. He was the closest associate to the late pope. Many did not want him to assume the throne because he would continue, they felt, some of the controversial policies of the late pope. In addition, there was a feeling that he was responsible for mismanagement of funds in the Vatican Bank, a major issue now, and that led to another cardinal being convicted of malfeasance and unable to vote in the conclave. Plus, he was responsible, they said, for the opening to China that will allow the Chinese government to have a hand in the selection of captive Catholic bishops. And Cardinal Jen of Hong Kong denounced him publicly. On the first two ballots, Parolini led the conservatives, the traditionalists in the College of Cardinals, stood with Cardinal Erdo of Romania, very much considered.
I thought he's from Hungary, actually.
Hungary, rather. Sorry, I had Romania on the brain after the election. Hungary. And Erdo came in second. All the conservatives were behind him. He stayed solid for two ballots as Parolini declined, but it was clear with votes spread to others, he was not going to win. So the conservatives behind them got to Cardinal Prevost, who had a handful of votes on the first two ballots. He took a lead on the third ballot and then won the necessary two-thirds on the fourth. Now, what is he like? As one cardinal told me on Saturday evening after the vote, "You've heard of Ivan the Terrible? Well, we've just been dealing with Francis the Terrible." And The late Pope was someone who did not countenance criticism. If he was criticized by anyone, he'd find a way to punish him. And that went down to pastors of local parishes known to say unkind things about him. He didn't like conservatives. And as the same cardinal said, the major influence in his life was Argentina's strongman, Juan Perón, and he carried out Perón's philosophy. For my friends, everything. For my enemies, not even justice. And Cardinal Burke of St. Louis was someone who had been publicly critical of the Pope. They raised the rent on his Vatican apartment and denied him his pension. He told me he thinks this will be restored under Leo. The Pope, in a very strange move, did not like the traditional Latin Mass that Catholics have celebrated for thousands of years. And
Francis, you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is total contrary to his predecessors, John Paul and Benedict, who made it easy for Catholics who preferred to celebrate that way to do it. It's widely expected Leo will go back to their policies. But overall, I think you're going to see someone who is not Francis, who will be, for lack of a better word, center-right, and someone who will be most interesting to watch. Already, he's volunteered to mediate between Russia and Ukraine. And of course, President Trump said he's very much open to the idea. So the only thing I would say is that, like Francis, he's been a missionary. He's worked with the poor in Latin America and will probably continue to speak out for the poor and talk about social justice. But in terms of managing the church and maintaining tradition, there'll be a lot of John Paul and Benedict in the new Pope, Leo the 14th.
The most important thing you didn't bring up, obviously he's an American, as you mentioned, he's born in Chicago, but he is a huge Chicago White Sox fan.
White Sox fan.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And on June 14th, the White Sox are celebrating his papacy at a game. They've already put up a thing on the wall out in the outfield somewhere where his seat was when he sat there in a White Sox top, a uniform top, in the 2005 World Series, which the White Sox won. And he's a White Sox fan. And the idea of an American Pope who's going to be sitting in the Vatican caring about the scores of Chicago White Sox games, I just can't get over it. I just think we never could have predicted it.
I've predicted, John, that when he comes to the United States, he will say Mass at Wright Field, home of the White Sox, and it will be billed, and I've already come up with my headline, as the Sermon on the Mound.
I like that.
The Sermon on the Mound.
I do.
That is fantastic.
Well, I kept thinking about you, John Gizzi, when, you know, you were over there. And I guess the thing that surprised me the most is somebody who knows nothing about this is that everything I read that said this is going to be a longer thing than four boats, that it might go on for days. And I was just surprised that it lasted as short as it did before a winner was announced.
Well, let me put it this way. You have to go back more than a century to find a conclave that took more than 4 days. In 1978, John Paul II, the first non-Italian pope in 400 years, was elected in a four-day period. Francis, the first pope from the Western Hemisphere, was elected in barely 3 days. They have two ballots in the morning. They break on. They vote for two more ballots, and, you know, then they pray, have dinner, and talk among themselves. It's not hard for rational people to reach a decision in a matter of a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are stories about the conclaves of the Middle Ages going on for a year. And finally, the people in Rome got so tired of it, they stopped sending food in to starve them out and help them make up their minds. That does not happen anymore, and it hasn't happened in modern times.
By the way, John, I think, and it doesn't get reported as much, that the key period here was after Francis died, and all the cardinals flew to Rome for the funeral. And then they announced they would be a week and a half later when the conclave would begin and all the cardinals are in town. That week and a half is where this thing is really decided. They meet, they talk, they dine, they go out around Rome, they have dinners and they're campaigning. Right. And it is campaigning and it is politics. And and then when they don't know each other, most of these cardinals were appointed by Francis. They've never met each other until this type of event. So they have 10 days freewheeling with a few events, but most of them they're free to do whatever and get to know each other and campaign always with an eye on this conclave that's upcoming. And so when they go into the Sistine Chapel, they've winnowed, the primary has been held. They've winnowed down the candidates. I'll tell you a funny story. 1986-ish, maybe. I sort of became friendly through an issue with Cardinal O'Connor, John Cardinal O'Connor of New York, who is a remarkable man who rose to the top of two of the most difficult bureaucracies ever, the Catholic Church to become Cardinal of New York, Bishop of New York, and the U.S. Navy, where he ended up as a rear admiral. He was a chaplain in Vietnam, in the jungles, doing services, funerals, last rites, everything for the Marines and who were dying in the jungle. And he was there so long that the Navy ordered him back to America for a year after he was there, I think for 2 years in the war. He comes back. Now he's in the Navy, so he can come back and do whatever he wants. He elects to go to Georgetown and get his PhD in political theory or something, where his main instructor at Georgetown was Jean Kirkpatrick.
Mm.
And one day I was sitting with her somewhere and I brought this up and she said to me, quote, John O'Connor was the most brilliant student I ever taught. And so there he is. Yeah. So he's a rear admiral retired. He's then the Bishop of New York, Cardinal O'Connor. And I went to him for my pet cause, the American prisoners of war left behind in captivity alive at the end of the Vietnam War. And if anybody would relate to it, it's him because he was, as I said, in Vietnam. So he meets me twice, once in his office, once in his house behind St. Patrick's. And after the first meeting, here's what he said to me that relates to this conclave. He says, John, I know what to do now. I'm going to help you out. I'll make the phone calls. You say the prayers. Mm. So here a cardinal is saying, I'll make the phone calls. You say the prayers. In other words, they're more political than we are, these guys. Mm. They've played politics to become a cardinal and all the other things they have to manipulate to get where they got. They're sharp about this stuff. And that's what I saw from afar. And John Gizzi just told us about it. It is. A Chicago-style convention.
Yeah. And wouldn't you know it, a White Sox fan comes out as Pope. Go figure. I will also tell you that it will be interesting to see how he plays on the world scene and with world leaders. John Paul met with people who disagreed with him, including General Jaruzelski, the strongman communist ruler of his native Poland, and he helped bring the government down. It will be very interesting to watch just what Pope Leo does in regard not only to Ukraine, but to the Middle East and India and Pakistan and other places. And again, these are places without a major Catholic population. The Pope speaks for 1.4 billion Catholics worldwide. When he speaks, people listen.
Yeah. By the way, to bring politics into him for a minute, American politics, he is a registered Republican who voted in Republican primaries in Illinois in 2012, 2014, and 2016. And I think he's closer to me in that he has tweeted against both Trump and Vance. So my guess is he's a Reagan Republican. Yes, he's center right, as Reagan Republicans are, but he's not a Trump. He's not a Trumper, and he will get along with Trump fine. He knows how to do it. Guy is very smooth about meeting and talking to people. We've already seen it when he met with Vance. It was very cordial. This guy's very sharp, and he's going to do well, I think, on the world political stage as well as religiously.
I want to ask about Vance. I want to ask about something else, but Vance thing I find fascinating, and I'm not a Catholic. So Vance essentially said that we, and if I have this wrong, you feel free to correct me, that you start with loving your family, you start with loving your community, you sort of add circles, and then if you have something left, you love the folks who, you know, who are part of the world, the rest of the world. And the Pope Francis said, that's not the way it works. And I find that to be a sort of a fascinating sort of disconnect, or not just disagreement. I'm just curious what you all think about that sort of disagreement.
Well, I don't think that's what Jesus, Jesus said, love your neighbors, love your enemies, love everybody.
Yeah.
You don't love your family more than other people. Where's that come from? You know, and Vance is a converted Catholic. He's very ardent in his Catholicism, which is great. He obviously was the last person to meet Pope Francis on Easter Sunday before the Pope died late that night, next morning. And then he was right back over there to meet Pope Leo. So he's very into it, which is great. But I don't think I would take him. He's not a spokesman for Catholicism.
No, I would have to say he's also the first convert to Catholicism ever to serve in national office. And what he says and his actions are watched worldwide. I saw him speak at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast this year. And one of the things he pointed out is why he's asked, he said, why don't you speak out against Pope Francis when he clearly disagrees with a lot of his fellow churchmen and women in the United States on issues such as immigration? And he said, it's not my job or the job of any official who happens to be Catholic to get into a debate with a Holy Father. What I prefer to recall is when he prayed all alone during COVID in the center of St. Peter's Square, and how he called on the world, just hang tough in this and see it through. That's how I choose to remember him. And of course, Pope Francis was seriously ill, the vice president said, and I pray for him every day. That's the kind of message that he will get into, not get into a debate with the current Holy Father or the late Holy Father.
Yeah, good.
I will be curious to see how things play out, because to me, that's a very wide disagreement about how to love people.
Yeah. But and you know, it's
one of those things that's just going to have to be worked out over time, I guess.
Yeah. You know, Peter, when I think of that and I think of Vance converting to Catholicism, and John, tell us, when in his life did he convert?
Was in college.
Okay. So he wasn't yet necessarily headed for a political career, but
no.
When we think back on our youth, my youth anyway, when I was 7 when President Kennedy got elected, and being a Catholic was a huge negative for him, big negative.
Yeah.
And it had been for Al Smith too, a previous Democratic nominee Catholic for president. And the charge always was, well, who's this guy's boss going to be, Rome or the American people? And here we are 65 years. Yep, 65 years later after Kennedy's election, and not only is it not a negative to be a Catholic, but a guy would switch to be a Catholic. That's not a negative either, you know? It's good.
All right. Before we, Bob, I know we're getting close to questions. I just want to talk a little about this big, beautiful bill that passed the House. What do both of you think about it and its prospects?
Which bill is that, Peter?
It's the only bill.
Oh, Okay.
Yeah.
This is the reconciliation bill that the House passed by one vote 2 days ago, yesterday, I think.
Yeah, and just a postscript, John. Since January, three congressmen died, all Democrats. Had two been alive, it would have been defeated. So
that's right.
This was fate. And the last Congressman Jerry Connolly of Northern Virginia died Wednesday morning on the eve of the vote.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and the former mayor of Houston, that's a Democratic congressman, he died.
Sylvester Turner.
Yeah, he died a couple months ago. And who's the third one?
Raul.
The funny Greenwald. Name. Yeah. Yeah, from Texas.
Right.
Yeah.
Obviously,
from Arizona.
Passed on very, slender votes. Well, what's going to happen now? It's going to go to the Senate. What do you think the Senate's going to do?
You go first, John. You go. Go.
Okay. The Senate is 54 Republicans, 46 Democrats. On paper, it should be a slam dunk for the administration. But one has to realize if it's going to go strictly along partisan lines, Senators Collins of Maine and Murkowski of Alaska can easily go against it, as they have on other measures supported by the president, not all, but others. And Mitch McConnell, who is retiring, he is someone the president does not like personally, doesn't speak to, has been quite nasty toward. He votes his heart on these things, and he could easily vote no on it. And my guess is, I don't think he will in the end, but the vote in the Senate will be closer, but it should pass the big, beautiful bill, and Trump will sign it soon enough.
Okay,
but for those people who are listening who don't know the details of this bill, could you give us a brief explanation?
Sure. It extends the Trump tax cuts from 2017. They were set to expire this year. It also makes spending cuts, including, most controversially, in Medicaid, the entitlement to help those who can't afford medical care. Now, supporters of the cuts in Medicaid say that so much is fraudulent, that the system allows people who can afford their own health care to get in a system in which government pays all and makes it harder for the underprivileged and the downtrodden to get health care. In any event, the cuts were made in that program. It still includes the Biden administration's funding for green economic programs. In other words, a conversion from traditional sources such as coal and oil and gasoline to green energy. The green subsidies, many conservatives wanted out. That's why they balked at passing it in the budget committee. The Medicaid reforms to eliminate fraud were supposed to take place in 2029, and at the insistence of conservatives in the House, they'll take effect immediately. Overall, this is as comprehensive a bill as Bill Clinton's 1993 bill, which had major tax increases, and Ronald Reagan's 1981 measure that John LeBouclier voted for that rolled back spending and gave a major across-the-board tax cut to everyone. It's a bill of consequence that will have an impact on the economy. Democrats say it will increase the deficit by $5 trillion in 5 years. Right. Republicans say that it will give such an impetus to the engine of the free market system that with the creation of new jobs, there'll be taxes paid earlier, and it actually will bring down the deficit. Time will tell on this. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say a couple things. The breakdown in the Senate is not, it's 53 Republicans, not 54. There are 53 Republican senators. You listed off three possible no votes, Collins, Murkowski, McConnell. And I'll give you a couple others, which is Rand Paul has voiced a lot of disagreement with things in the House version of this bill. But it's going to come over to the Senate. It's going to get changed. All the stuff John just went through, the Medicaid stuff is getting changed a lot in the Senate. Many Republican senators, Ron Johnson of all people, has voiced strong disagreement with this stuff. And so the bill will be redone in the Senate, and that may not be acceptable back in the House by the House Freedom Caucus or the SALT Caucus, which the SALT stands for State and Local Tax, S-A-L-T. Right. And in the first tax bill that John just mentioned, 2017, Trump is president, Republicans have the House and Senate, and they passed this tax cut, which was mostly a tax cut for the upper income brackets and a corporate tax cut. And in there, they put a $10,000 a year tax deduction for your state and local taxes. That's 8 years ago. Many Republican congressmen from New York, New Jersey, Illinois, they're not in Illinois, California, have said that's not going to work anymore. We got to have more than $10,000 deduction. So Speaker Johnson gave them $40,000 a year per person, $80,000 for a married couple if the income is under 500 grand. That's a lot of tax deduction. And already I read senators are not happy with that. That's too much money that they'll have to make up somewhere else. So that's all that's to keep Medicare, these tax deductions. And John, you say the Democrats claim this thing's going to blow up the debt. It's the Congressional Budget Office that said it. $5 trillion, well, this bill. The nonpartisan John, Congressional Budget Office. That's not the Democrats.
We could have a nice debate sometime on CBO, you know, and I'm going to say this. I've read the gospel a lot in my life. The CBO figures are not gospel for one.
No, of course not.
The other thing is, when you say it's nonpartisan, its leanings have never been conservative, and no Republican speaker, beginning with Newt Gingrich, has ever overhauled the office completely and brought in his own person. It's an insider place. That's a circumlocutious way of saying, I don't trust CBO figures.
Well, that may be. It may be. And whether this thing will lower the debt, who knows? The markets are not happy with this bill.
Oh,
but the bill has a long way to go, not months-wise, but in changes in the Senate, as I outlined.
I think we can bring in some of our participants to our program. You're listening to In Perspective, and our guests are former New York Congressman John LeBoutillier and political columnist from Newsmax, John Gizzi. So let me ask Cindy if anybody is interested in asking questions.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Okay, let's see. Hey, everybody, get your hands up there. Takes a couple seconds for... Okay, here we go. Robert Acosta. Bob, go ahead.
Bob from California. Welcome.
Yep.
Robert?
Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, there we go.
There we are.
First of all, bring these guys on every week. They're fantastic and very fair, and I appreciate that. I'm sorry the Pope is a White Sox fan. I lost to the Cubs for many years, and now we're better. So there we go. I want to basically... There's tremendous fear with older people dependent on these programs. I happen to be blind. We're fearful we're going to lose everything. And yet my friends in the Republican Party say, don't worry, paradise is right around the corner. Can you, it's not a great question here, but can you handle the fear? Can you tell us, hey, things are going to be okay? Thank you.
Well, I'll go first. No, I wouldn't. I have been astounded at the willy-nilly way Musk and Doge, and this is allowed by Trump, took I was going to say a meat cleaver, but of course it's a chainsaw, to the executive branch departments, the administration of these departments. And I really don't think that's what the public voted for. I'll give you a great example. My brother-in-law is a veteran. He gets his health care in a veterans hospital in Florida. 2 months ago, he goes over there for something and learns that that week, DOGE had fired all the scrub nurses. Those are the nurses in the operating rooms at that hospital. So suddenly no surgeries available to the veterans who get their health care in that hospital. Now that the public doesn't want that. We don't want to fire scrub nurses. We don't want to fire nuclear regulators. We want to fire the proverbial lazy federal worker who doesn't work. Okay, great. We all want to get rid of them. And it's not easy to find who they are, but that's what they should have been doing. Not the chainsaw that has put this caller in abject fear of his benefits that keep him going.
Thank you.
Bob?
John Gizzy?
Okay, if not, we'll see if John Gizzy wants to respond.
I will respond, and I'd point out this. In Argentina, a country that's had socialism for governance for 80 years, President Javier Milei came in, and he did apply a chainsaw to government, eliminating 70,000 jobs with the stroke of a pen on his first day in office and closing 11 of 18 cabinet ministries. Now, having said that, then he moved, by the way, to dollarize the peso, which is something very dramatic and very bold. Having said that, Argentina, as much as they waste money and tax dollars, they do not touch the lives of people like John's brother-in-law the way programs in the United States does. Put another way, it's a lot easier to cut programs and government offices in Argentina than it is in the United States. The U.S. Agency for International Development has a lot of waste and corruption in it. On the other hand, it does a lot of good with its programs.
Past tense. They got rid of it. Doesn't exist.
Yeah. It's been put, its remnants are in the State Department. And also, Voice of America, my closest friend, best man at my wedding, whom John was acquainted with, made films and productions for VOA that were very important in the Cold War, touched a lot of people. There's many stories like his and the good VOA was doing in Asia and Africa now is as important as it was in the Cold War, and it's being shut down. I spoke today to a lady who had a VOA position. She is out of work immediately. So there's a lot of hurt that's going on, and quite honestly, Elon Musk and Doge were not the face for reform. J. Peter Grace, grand old man of Wall Street, someone John knew, headed a commission that recommended cuts in expenditures under Ronald Reagan. He was a respectable person people listened to. Former President Herbert Hoover headed a commission that recommended major cuts and reform in government. Senator John F. Kennedy introduced a lot of the legislation to put the Hoover Commission's recommendations into effect. It was bipartisan. This is not bipartisan in the tradition of Hoover and Grace, and it's hurting.
Right, and it, politically, it will not help Trump in the long run. It's a big negative. Elon Musk, it has, he's finished in terms of influence inside the U.S. government. No one wants to hear him or be with him. Yeah. And it, he's cost himself and his private business companies, Tesla and SpaceX, their stock value is way down because of his behavior with this Doge thing. And, you know, again, Republicans have always campaigned, and I did it too, for cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. And we all believe in a $4.5 trillion budget there's got to be a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse. And there is. But finding it requires a lot of work and interviews and hearings and all. And Congress appropriates the money. I don't believe in the end the courts will sanction the executive to just cancel out the stuff that Congress appropriated. And in the end, I don't think they will. And I think we'll go back where Congress will have to be the one. They want to end the Department of Education. Okay. That's been in the Republican platform since 1980. Every 4 years, my party says we ought to get rid of it. We didn't ever have it. Education was better in America before we had it. We've had it ever since Jimmy Carter paid off the, rewarded the teachers unions after he won in 76. He created this thing and it's become huge and the Republicans want to get rid of it. Very legitimate debate. Have it, get rid of it, reduce it, whatever. But you can't just willy-nilly eliminate it unless Congress gets rid of it legally. And that is where I think Trump has run at odds with the law, the courts, and ultimately Congress.
I have a comment, but I want to make sure there aren't any other questions. Thank you, Bob Acosta, and thanks for the kind words.
Anybody else, Cindy?
Yes, and you have 6.5 minutes. And
thank you.
Okay, Valerie, go ahead.
Hey, Valerie.
And you're muted. There you are.
Okay.
You're good.
What I'm wondering about is I'm worried about Medicare cuts, and we've been hearing rumblings for many years and this year too about cuts in Social Security as well. And I'm very worried about it. Do we have reason to worry? I mean, if you're on an HMO like Medi-Cal and some other thing like Molina or United Healthcare or something, are you safer? Would they cut out the entire Medicare and Medi-Cal, or would it just be under certain conditions they cut it out? And what's going on with Social Security? And another question I have is, because we're not getting much information about what's happening with that. And another question I have is, what kind of power do we have to resist this administration? Because he's going against the Constitution, but taking all power like he's acting like he's the king of the United States. What can we actually do to fight this? I don't see any effective thing being done.
Well, in 17 months, you get a chance to vote in a national election for the House and Senate, depending on where you are.
Yeah, but it's time sensitive. What if he hurts us all financially and we lose everything before the next election?
Well, there's not much we can do other than tell your own Congress people to stand up to Trump,
if they're Republican, they
won't do. Republicans will not go against Trump.
They're working against the American people. What the hell can we do about this?
You vote them out in 2026. That's all you can do. Yeah. As for Social Security and Medicare, Trump has repeatedly said, and he also said it about Medicaid, we're not touching it. And I don't think he will touch Social Security or Medicare. Medicaid, which as John Gizzi talked about, was more for the poor. They are in this big, one big, beautiful bill. They already took a whack at that thing and they're going to work on it in the Senate. So we don't know the ultimate product of that. But
what does that mean? Will we still get some benefits in Medicaid? Those of us who are on Medi-Cal or California, it's Medi-Cal. Are they taking it away or what?
I don't know. Is Medi-Cal part of Medicaid or Medicare?
It's a state program.
So it's Medicaid.
Yeah.
It's a state program. Mostly funded. Yeah, but if it's a state program, it's a state program funded by the state. Medicaid is partly funded by the state and the feds in a combination. So I don't know what this thing is, but they're going to try to cut it. They want to cut spending and the only place they found. And John Gizzi, we haven't talked about it. Not a peep out of them about cutting a dollar out of the Defense Department. With the $600 hammer and all that stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I have one more question.
Hold on. Go ahead, John Gizzi.
Defense spending actually goes up in the big, beautiful bill, as does Homeland Security spending to protect the border. Trump's most popular policy has been to keep illegal immigrants out, deport others, and in many cases, this has been going to be very popular, but it's also a very expensive policy, as is the completion of the wall along the border. And, you know, it's a matter, everybody wants to go to heaven, no one wants to die to get there. And it's very hard to cut programs. Department of Education, I thought it was a no-brainer back in 1981, and it's grown bigger than ever at this point. Other things, I never thought that Trump would make them his first priority. And as you say, ma'am, it's going to hurt. But we're not a parliamentary system with votes of confidence. The House and Senate have to agree right down to the comma on legislation. And then in the next election, if you don't like it, you can vote for people who will undo it.
I think part of the problem about all of this is there's a whole lot of mistrust of each other, of the other. I think among Trump supporters, there is a real fear that President Trump is trying to consolidate power away from Congress and away from the courts. And that the courts and Congress, well, the Congress doesn't have the will to do it right now. And the courts, you know, can only do so much. And he's doing things with the courts. It is a scary time. And, I don't have any good answers, but I hope that we can acknowledge that a lot of people are really, really nervous.
You have 1 minute.
Anything else, Val?
Is it true that I heard that they might try and hold him in contempt of court if he could be violating or trying to violate court orders. And what happens? They can't put the president in jail or punish him for anything. And because he's the president, does that mean that where's justice in all this? That he can get away with doing anything he wants?
The only I'll just quickly answer. I share your fear, but the justice will come from the people through the electoral system. Not he's not going to be put in jail for contempt or anything else.
No.
But he can be pushed back by the courts, by public opinion, by the financial markets, which do push back. And then in 2026, I'm pretty sure the Democrats will win the House back. John Gizzi and I can discuss it the next time we're on.
And that,
That acts as a check against Trump. Okay. Thank you.
Gentlemen, we appreciate you being on, and we will invite both of you back in the near future. John LeBoutelier, John Gizzi, thanks very much. It's been very informative. Keep up the good work. Thank you, everyone else. We do have to run. I'm Bob Branco. Go safe with God's abundant blessings. Take care, everybody.